Good morning, Greenwich. It's 9:30 on Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk with me, Jen Graziano. I'm the co-owner of Cox & Graziano Funeral Home, located at 134 Hamilton Avenue, and as part of my family's commitment to the community, I come to you every Wednesday, talking to people that matter, about things that matter, in a place that matters, right here in Greenwich. Enjoying the early taste of spring this Wednesday morning. Don't get too used to it, folks. March is around the corner. We know how that goes. But we're talking about a subject today that impacts so many of us and family members that we've loved, perhaps family members that we've lost, whether you're in Greenwich or anywhere throughout that you're listening to this broadcast today. I'm sure it affects some of us very deeply. But the subject of hospice and palliative medicine, we're going to dispel some of the notions, explain the concept behind this approach to treatment, and talk with our expert, Dr. Donna Coletti. But I welcome listeners to 1490 WGCH. And good morning, Facebook Live viewers. Thanks to Bob and Tim. And a great show in store. So I welcome you, Doctor.
Thank you, Jen.
Your personal bedside manner and kindness I can certainly attest to. I mean, the show was really, I had wanted to have you on air for a while, but you came to an on-site visit to sign a death certificate, which was so kind of you. And I can really see that this is a mission for you, and this is something that's not just a job. You're very passionate about hospice and palliative medicine, educating and caring for patients as well. Tell us a bit about yourself and your unique background first, though.
Well, thank you, Jen, for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to express my thoughts and my intentions about palliative care and hospice care, because as you alluded to, I do view it very much as a vocation and much more than a profession.
Absolutely.
And the reason I say that is I came to it from a very unique perspective. My initial introduction to medicine was really through nutrition. I had a master's in nutrition before I ever would consider going into any other discipline. And it was simply because I worked at Cornell Medical College that I actually got introduced to medicine and went down that path. So fundamentally, I always approached life really from a holistic nutritional perspective and always use that filter no matter what subdiscipline I went into.
That's so interesting, though, because if you think about it, the essence of nutrition, again, it's wellness. It's just the mindfulness that, you know, of the body and how it works, and it's a system and what we put into it. But it's a very interesting perspective to begin your medical career from that standpoint, because like you say, you've approached it throughout the tenure of your career with a call to mindfulness and overall wellness.
For sure. You know, it's about being present and not just taking advantage of whatever food and resources are before you, but rather making a conscious effort and recognizing that, actually, Dr. Boyd, one of our oncologists who also has a degree in nutrition and is an integrated physician as well, he has an expression that you are what you eats. Right?
it's very good. Takes that one step further.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so everything gets incorporated into your body, not just from your own nutrition, but from the nutrition you take in, what they've taken in.
That's very, very true. And especially nowadays, I mean, and we can, I'm sure, spend hours on this, but, you know, cancer rates are higher. You know, it's much more prevalent. And much more people are impacted. And at younger ages, I mean, it seems to just run the gamut of who is impacted by this. And you have to analyze, well, where is it coming from? What is the cause? And food and what we are putting in our bodies, there's such a different makeup today than what it was years ago.
For sure. And so what it comes down to is evolutionary biology, right? And going back to really what the diet of man was versus what the diet of man is.
Oh, it's so different.
And also in the context of environment. You know, environmental toxins are a real large impact on our health and our wellness throughout our lives. And what is rarely acknowledged is that lifetime of behaviors and environment is what leads to cancer and illness. And so, you know, the different lifestyles in the Midwest versus the different lifestyles in India versus the different lifestyles in the Northeast or the South.
Regional variation.
Yeah, absolutely. Impacts your wellness.
Environmental markers, and I'm sure there's so many interesting studies that would bolster what your findings are. So this call to mindfulness, this overall approach to wellness, led you into a much different type of medicine. How did you begin? What was your first area of practice?
So, you know, in medical school, I was one of those people who I did neurology. I'm going to be a neurologist. You know, I was coming from the Department of Pathology. So a familiar area for you.
Yes.
And I originally just thought I was going to be a pathologist because that was my training. I just was stimulated by so many different things until I delivered my first baby. And one of the residents who was overseeing me was actually someone who I had trained when I was working at Cornell. And I looked at him and I said, Larry, why didn't you tell me I was going to be an OBGYN? He goes, yeah, I always knew it. I figured you'd figure it out yourself. You know, so he goes, it's just too much fun. Right. It's just bringing life into the world is really a grace.
Absolutely. I can imagine no greater joy, but it makes it all the more interesting of the area that you practice now. You've really watched the circle of life firsthand, doctor. And I'm sure watching, being at the front lines of delivering life into this world gives you a heightened appreciation for it.
Absolutely. I refer to it really as the sacred space. You know, whether it's at the moment of birth or at the moment of death, it is a really hallowed and quiet moment. And despite all the frenetic and chaotic activities that are surrounding it, the actual moment is hallowed. And when you're in it, you know it. And it is the same, whether it is birth or death.
It's a comforting thought as well, I think.
For sure. And, you know, you always kind of go back to the Broadway play where they talk of the circle of life, you know, the Lion King, that the point of entry is the point of exit and life is what's in between. And it is the same point. And what it comes down to me truly is that it's about transition.
Okay.
It's about how the individual is experiencing that transition and how everyone around them is experiencing that transition. Because transitions are never easy, whether they're good transitions or bad transitions.
That's so true. That's so true. So I want to talk a little bit about dispelling the myths of palliative care and hospice, doctor, because you and I briefly chatted last week when I read Becoming Mortal. It was a fascinating book that was suggested that I read, and it opened my eyes and changed my perspective to hospice. Funeral directors and hospice, we work together so closely. And prior to reading that book, you know, my thought was always when you heard hospice, it was a word that just signified the end, and it was a word that brought such trepidation and sorrow to hear. And my perspective was completely turned around from reading this, because I recognize that hospice is not a sign of surrender or giving up. Rather, it's a way to preserve the quality of the life left. And I think so few people, I mean, well, not few, but I don't think as many people are as aware of that as perhaps should be. And they continue with treatments to no avail and perhaps are taking the time left and not using it as constructively. So I think it's important for you to educate listeners and viewers today as to the benefits and explain really what palliative medicine entails.
Thank you for pointing out one of the fundamental intentions that I have in my practice, which is to dispel the myths and the barriers to palliative and hospice medicine. So it's important to distinguish between the two because they are not one and the same.
Right.
They're not always one and the same.
Right, so please start there, because I think, again, that's something that this is not commonly held knowledge, I would say.
So palliative medicine in general is, in principle, for me, it's about pain and symptom management in the individual who is facing a serious, often life-threatening illness.
Okay.
But also helping to prevent post-traumatic stress and complicated grief in their relatives. Because the people who are the primary caregivers and primary relatives of someone who is facing a serious illness are often suffering along with them.
Absolutely. I mean, a disease impacts a family. Illness impacts a family. So you're actually treating a family unit.
Absolutely. So now you see the commonality with OBGYN.
Oh, it's so true.
Right? It's about transition.
There's
it's
a family about waiting for you to come in, and there's a family surrounding you as you transition out of this life. It's such a beautiful sentiment. And honestly, I've never, throughout my life's work, I've never seen it in the terms that you've just explained. So I think it's wonderful what you're sharing with everybody today.
Well, I'll share with you the anecdote of how it really came to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to be the medical director for the Rosenthal Hospice of Southwestern Connecticut after my dad had passed away under their care.
Okay.
And I said to the nurse who asked me to do this a year after my dad died, I said, Pat, I'm a gynecologist. You know that. She goes, yeah, but you're trainable. Don't worry. And I said, wow, that's the highest compliment a nurse ever gave me. So on the first day in the facility, she came to me and said, how you doing? And I said, Pat, if you'd only told me that this was labor and delivery, I would have been fine. She said, labor and delivery? What are you talking about? I said, the patients are all in transition and in pain. The families are all, frantic. And if one more person asks me, when's it going to happen?
Wow. Oh,
right?
My.
I said, this is labor and delivery, but it's labor and delivery of a different sort. But I know this.
That's such a parallel. I mean, that's such a surprising parallel. And again, it's the nerves, it's the angst, and it takes a different type of physician and medical and paramedical staff to treat these patients. This is not triage. This is not ER. And it's not to minimize any type of medical dilemma, but this is a different type of medicine. It requires a different type of personality for sure.
I agree. And someone who's had different experiences,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you have to put it in context.
Absolutely. The empathy and the sympathy, it's in my profession as well, I say there are people who do it and it's a business, and there are people who are just in it and feeling as they go along. And, I'm sure you and I could also discuss, there's a lot of pitfalls to that personally for us, but I think it makes you better at what you do when you are bringing your experience to the table.
And it keeps you present.
Absolutely.
For your
Absolutely.
Own wellness, right, and your own personal development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So returning back to hospice and palliative
yes.
care, so this is where my education came from, that I recognize that palliative care is about, as I said, helping people defining their goals of care and obtaining the care they want and avoiding the care they don't want by being very clear about what those goals are when they're facing a decision. Now, that decision may be end of life in what context we call hospice care.
Okay.
Right? It's the last phase.
So palliative care is not necessarily signifying that we're at this terminal end of life. It's more of a pain management, a decision for alternative care, alternative approaches, perhaps non-invasive treatments. It's a way to manage and to treat and to preserve that quality of life.
For sure. It's focusing on what the goals of the person were before they got ill, what they are now,
mm-hmm.
and how they perceive the future to be. And so what we try and do is we try and really get to know who this person was before they got sick. And, had they ever expressed what their wishes were before? And how does that correlate with what they're saying now?
So, and again, your integrative medicinal background comes into this because you can expand the patient to a whole series of alternative treatments that perhaps were not available prior to their decision to take on palliative care.
That's absolutely true. And it also allows a voice for their family. And because, when especially an older person, excuse me, is, facing the choices of, say, radiation or chemotherapy, something which has the potential of prolonging their life, but also adding more pain sometimes.
Absolutely.
And more trips to the doctor and interfering with their daily life's routine, they often have to weigh the pros and cons, the risks and benefits of doing that. If they take care of their grandchildren during the day, they don't want to then disappoint their family. But by the same token, mothers especially never want to have their family feel as though they're abandoning them. So if their family wants them to have chemo, they'll have chemo, with very silently and without ever saying, I really don't want this, because they don't want to disappoint anyone.
These are such hard conversations to have, and it's such a struggle between, I always say, you know, it's when I watch people come to me in the aftermath, you know, they would have done anything to have their loved ones stay, and we don't want to let go. And it's the most selfless act that you could possibly do, you know, when you say to someone, it's okay, you can go. And I have so many stories of people saying that once they've given that okay and given that blessing, they have passed. And for anyone who doesn't believe, for me, it's so real. It's so true. There's such power in that. But it's a struggle. It's a dichotomy of we want to hold them here, and then the patient doesn't want to disappoint family, like you say, and they want to be here for the family. But when you break it down, you're arguably, and this book that I referenced speaks to this, your time might not be different based on the treatment approach you take, the Western medicinal chemo radiation versus this. The difference is your quality of that time is better. And there's actually been studies to prove that this approach has extended life, even by a few months, but it's extended it with a quality that there was comfort, free of pain, the ability to go back and do some things or even, you know, tie up loose ends or have more lucid conversations with family members where important things were not left unsaid.
Absolutely. The most common roadblock that I believe patients and families come up against is the phrase of, oh, well, you're not ready for that type of care. You yes. know, there's plenty of hope here. We're not going to take away your hope. And, you know, other practitioners have said that to me. Well, you can't take away their hope. And my answer is always the same. Nobody wants to take away anyone's hope.
Right.
The point is to redefine that hope. Because it takes a lot of hubris to think that you know what someone else's hope is. You're actually expressing your own hope. You're
right,
not expressing
right, right.
their hope unless you ask them.
And it's a well-intentioned, again, and it's
yes.
this, you know, it's this nexus between hospice and palliative care and this notion of surrender and defeat. And that, I think, is what you're doing today, is you're dispelling that. It's not defeat. It's just preserving quality. Preserving quality of life.
It's actually empowerment,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Because you're actually turning the decision-making over to the person with regard to, will you tell us what is the most important thing to you? Is it time? Because if it's time, we respect that and we'll give you every opportunity to extend the time of your life. But if it's quality, then you have to define what that quality is so then we can figure out what the plan's going to be to help you achieve that quality.
It's developing a plan. So, Dr. Colletti, palliative care is somewhat of a precursor, though, to hospice. What is the distinction between hospice care?
So, hospice in America is a Medicare entitlement. It's called the Medicare Hospice Benefit that
okay.
private insurance provides for anyone under 65, but over 65, it's a government entitlement.
Okay.
So in our culture, when you say hospice, people automatically think, oh, they're on the hospice benefit, right? If you go anywhere else in the world, it's a philosophy of care.
Right, right.
If you say hospice in England, it's not, you know, a rubber stamp of what the government says they should be doing. You know, it's a philosophy of care. And so in America, when someone is on hospice, it really comes down to financials of who's paying for this type of care.
Okay.
And there's an unrealistic expectation when people think, oh, well, hospice is coming in, that, as I mentioned to you before, people think of it as Mary Poppins. You know, someone's going to come in, these nurses who are truly Florence Nightingales
yeah.
are going to
oh,
come
yes.
in, and they're going to take over the care. That's not really the reality of this.
So explain to us, doctor, what in fact they do.
When someone is on home hospice,
okay,
there's a home hospice agency which gets hired, which the government pays a net sum every month to take care of this person. But it's not to live in the house with the family and do that.
Can it become round-the-clock care? Is it patient-specific of what the needs are? There's a need assessment?
Absolutely. Okay. The initial needs assessment determines how many hours a week they can get a home health aide. But it's maximum 2 to 4 hours a day.
Are they clinical home health aides or more home health companions?
Home health companions who help with body care, cooking, personal care for the patient.
Medication administration?
No. That's the linchpin.
Okay. Now, I just learned that myself. So, and I have the utmost respect for all the hospice nurses. I mean, when they call in the middle of the night, I say they're just a special breed.
Absolutely.
To do that. But so they cannot administer medication. When you're under hospice care, I'm assuming there's a doctor or a clinician or somebody that will come in for maybe weekly visits. Okay.
Exactly. The nurse is scheduled to come in once a week.
Okay.
To make sure that the care is being administered appropriately and that the patient's condition doesn't warrant any changes in their plan. But the real intention of this goes back over 30 years where the government said, okay, families who want to take their loved one home and be the primary caregivers, that's where this entitlement came from.
So hospice is supplemental to the family being the primary caregiver.
That's exactly what it was, because it was initially intended for patients who want to bring their loved ones with cancer home, because they didn't want them to die in the hospital.
No, it's such I could even hear it with my own family members, you know, the comfort to die at home. It's so important to so many, and hospice is just an enabler to let that happen. But hospice doesn't take over that role as primary caregiver. It's really a family unit and a team. But hospice also provides, you know, necessary comforts and counseling. There's a lot of bereavement associated through hospice that you can direct a family to. So this whole model of medicine is treating the whole person and the emotional and the physical and the medical needs.
And the spiritual and the existential needs as well. Absolutely.
There's wonderful chaplains. We talked about Reverend Andrea as one of them. Again, you are preparing for the transition and recognizing it's not a journey that people take alone.
That's absolutely true. And that even after the person passes, there are ripple effects for the rest of the lives of the people who remain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When is the right time, Dr. Colletti, to discuss palliative medicine and hospice?
So if we dial back a little bit to define hospice benefit, as we discussed, it's a government entitlement which establishes that someone on average, two doctors actually have to attest, has a relative life expectancy of 6 months or less.
Okay.
So that's the initial requirement. You don't have to die in 6 months, but that most people with the condition that the person has, who isn't going to pursue curative treatment, would pass in 6 months.
Do you advise, though, from your perspective, that the conversation be had earlier, that if somebody does take on a diagnosis, again, of a serious illness, do you suggest that conversation be had at the early onset?
I believe these conversations should occur actually even further back than that.
Okay.
When people are well.
I'm a big proponent of that. You have these hard talks when life is good and life is fine, because that's when you have clarity and a different perspective.
And it's a point in time, right? Because goals change.
Yes.
Right? Hope changes. Right. So palliative care talks about redefining hope, because the hope that someone got at the moment they had a diagnosis is not the hope they had 5 minutes before. He's not going to tell me what this diagnosis is. Right. But when that diagnosis comes in, that's a different hope.
Your life changes on a dime.
And you have to define what that hope is, and that over time it's going to keep changing. To the point of where, as Dr. Gawande pointed out in his book, his father's hope was just to be able to enjoy chocolate ice cream and watch a ball game.
Absolutely.
Right? And he was a urologist who had extraordinary bona fides and who started, you know, a school in India.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just happy to have chocolate ice cream. And Atul said, if I could just get him that,
yes,
then I was considered a whole. You know, having closure myself. Right?
And I think that's interesting, too, because it helps a family when you redefine the goals. You know, they might not realize how simple it is to help the person, the patient. There's so many simple things that we might take for granted, like, well, that's not what they need, you know, the chocolate ice cream. But it makes it more attainable to give the comfort to your loved one when you realize sometimes it's just the simple and basic needs that they have.
Absolutely. And, you know, another initiative of palliative care is to move away from the emotional language, especially around food. You know, I don't want my loved one to starve. Right. Or, you know, they're getting sounding very congested. I don't want them to drown.
Right.
You know, we try and take families away from language that's emotionally laden to more basic life, blood pressure, heart rate, vital sign oriented discussion.
Sure.
Right? So that we can take the emotion out so that they can then start to view their loved one as physiologically being compromised and how we can treat that. And once again, it's an empowerment. You know, they're congested. Let's give them a decongested. They're not drowning, you know. And we try to dispel myths and take the emotion out so that the person, the caregivers themselves, can dial down their own
it's
inner
true
voices.
Because, you know, again, you're providing comfort. You're treating an immediate need. You're doing so with a level head. And you recognize these are very emotionally charged situations. I have to have you back on air because our time is drawing to a close. But there's so much more we can say. Can you leave our audience with some final thoughts, though, on palliative medicine, Dr. Colletti?
Sure. I believe that in general, people should have these conversations around the holiday dinner tables. I believe they should do it on average when they're 50 years old and they realize they're at an age where they're helping their children as well as their families, as well as themselves. So I think that addressing these issues in a non-threatening and a non-chaotic and stressful environment is the best way to help at least establish one point in time about how someone feels about what their wishes are.
Wonderful advice, Dr. Colletti. I thank you so much. You will be back on air. And this is Jen Graziano thanking you all for taking the time to listen today as we took the time to talk. I hope this information resonated with many of you and changed some perspectives. Thank you so much, Dr. Colletti. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Jen.
Bye-bye.
The station you grew up with, 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
In Congress, differing opinions. I'm John Trout. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer assesses last night's speech from the president.
It was not a good speech. The president's hurting. He knows he's hurting, but he doesn't seem able to dig himself out of the hole and give a truly bipartisan speech and start working with us. We want to work with him.
Meantime, Trump says the State of the Union is great.
Madam Speaker!
As the president approached the rostrum, he seemed to exchange pleasantries and a handshake with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. When the applause died,